How's it going, everybody? Welcome back to Let's Talk Sports with me, your host, Dalton Stogsdill. On today's show, we're going to talk about the problem with the MLB free agency, why I wouldn't want to coach in the NFL or college, and the craziness that is the divisional round of the NFL playoffs. Before I get started, I really just want to thank everybody that gave me feedback on my first episode last week. I appreciate the love and advice y'all gave me, and from the bottom of my heart, thank you for supporting me in this podcast. I won't get into it too much, but if you haven't seen Making a Murderer on Netflix, you should really carve out some time in your week to watch that. It's an amazing documentary, and most people think it's trying to prove the man innocent, but for me, it's more about how messed up this criminal justice system is. And I'm not going to spoil it for people, but watch it. It is absolutely amazing. Anyways, let's dive into the pricey world of the MLB free agency. I'm going to give you guys some numbers here, and I'm going to let you draw your own conclusions on whether or not these players deserve what they're getting paid. But here's the top five. Number one is David Price. Got a 7-year, $217 million deal with Boston. Zach Greinke got a 6-year, $206.5 million deal with Arizona. Jason Hayward signed an 8-year, $184 million deal with Chicago Cubs. Johnny Cueto signed a 6-year, $130 million deal with San Francisco. And Jordan Zimmermann signed a 5-year, $110 million deal with Detroit. That is an insane amount of money for a starting pitcher. And it's all being thrown at them by these big market teams. Why would you pay a player hundreds of millions of dollars if they only play every 5 days? Why would you do that? Why wouldn't you pay an everyday player? Somebody that's going to give you production every single day and make a difference every single day. That kind of money. Why would you pay a player that's going to start once every 5 days? Can someone please explain that to me? Because to me, that doesn't make any sense. I understand that you need pitching in the MLB. And I get that if you can pitch and the other team can't hit the ball, that makes sense. But if you can't score, you can't win either. Why wouldn't you pay a position player that much? Why wouldn't you pay an outfielder that much? Jason Hayward, of those players that I mentioned, is the only person that is worthy of that kind of money because he can hit the ball and he can field the ball. He is in the essence of a five-tool player in every sense of the word. And if you're a big market team and you're paying a pitcher $200 million a year or $200 million contract over 6 years, you better be damn sure that he's going to win in the postseason. David Price, he can't win in the postseason. He's shown you that with the Rays. He's shown you that with Toronto. The man cannot win in the postseason. Johnny Cueto, he'll probably get you to the postseason, but he was shaky at best in the postseason. He was shaky during the regular season in Kansas City. I don't know if part of that was because it was a transitional thing for him and he couldn't necessarily get the pieces to fit together in a new city, new town, and it was just a shock to his system or something. But the only pitcher that's worth that kind of money is Zach Greinke. The dude can win in the regular season. The one shot he had in the postseason, he dominated with the Dodgers. It doesn't work that way. What teams in the MLB need to do nowadays is they have to develop players. The Royals and the Cubs and the Mets have all shown, even the Astros have shown, that if you can develop these young guys, you can win now. You don't have to go out. You don't have to pay a David Price $216 million to get you to the postseason. Jason Hayward, like I said before, only person that's worth it because he will get you to the postseason and he will more than likely perform in the postseason. But what happens whenever these smaller market teams develop these young guys and they beat these big market teams that are throwing millions and millions and millions of dollars at these players that don't deserve the money they're getting, all these big market teams are going to do is come around and poach the small market teams. They're just going to poach the smaller players. And it's an unfortunate thing because you don't see players stay with one team anymore. You don't see the George Bretts stay with one team anymore. You don't see those guys anymore because they all chase money. They don't have a sense of of camaraderie and a team mentality in that clubhouse, because all these players are chasing money. You can't win if all your players are chasing money. You've seen that with the Dodgers. You've seen that with the Nats, with the Nationals. You cannot give players millions upon millions of dollars and have several of them on your roster and expect to do good, because all they care about is that dollar amount. All they care about is that incentive in their contract. And if you have players that the only thing they care about is what they get at the end of the season, you're not going to win in this league. But all that being said, I'd much rather be a manager in the MLB, because at least I can develop talent, and hopefully my club will give me a couple of years to develop these players and get them to where I feel as a coach that they need to be. Because in the NFL, you sure as hell don't get that opportunity. You see that with Lovie Smith in Tampa Bay. Dude went 2-4 in his first year at Tampa Bay. Had a terrible quarterback situation with Josh McCown, who signed with Cleveland, played 2 games, and then was done because he can't play. He's a horrible, horrible quarterback. He had no O-line that year. Had a horrible defense. And in his second season with Tampa Bay, he goes 6-10. I'd say that's a pretty vast improvement. Triple your win total with a rookie QB. That's a hell of an improvement from 2-4. And then he gets fired. Can you explain that to me? If somebody in Tampa Bay is listening to this, can you explain that to me somehow? Because that sure as hell don't make any sense to me. If I'm a coach, and I'm wanting to be a head coach in the NFL someday, and I see that these teams, they gave me 2 years to improve. I improved, and that still wasn't a good enough improvement for them. Because why? I can't compete with Carolina in the NFC South? Because I can't beat Carolina, who went 14-2 in the regular season? I get punished because I can't beat them? That's not my problem. That's the front office problem. From a coaching standpoint, that's a great season. 6-2 from 2-14. That's a hell of an improvement. But the front office, they want money. And the way you get money is you get into the playoffs. That's the only way you get money in the NFL. And if you don't get to the playoffs, you're a loser, according to the NFL. But Lovie Smith, he wasn't a loser. He's proven that in Chicago. He went to the Super Bowl with Chicago, then he had a couple of down seasons, and they fired him. In the NFL, you're going to have down seasons. But if you see that your coach is rapidly improving his record and improving stats with rookie players and young players like Jameis Winston, who should win Offensive Rookie of the Year on a completely different note, but he won't. I don't understand why an organization would cut them if you can see that they're improving. Because to me, you want these young players to stay with the same system in the NFL so they can have that continuity. You see that in Cleveland. The reason these players aren't getting any better in Cleveland is because they're consistently changing the system every year. You can't win if your players have to learn a new playbook every season. You can't do it. And you saw that, and you see that in Tampa Bay. They had the same playbook for 2 seasons, and look what they did. Tripled their win record. But it's not good enough in the NFL anymore. Or even in college, for that matter. Mark Richt got fired from Georgia after a 9-3 season. By Georgia standards, that's average. Any other college, that's a great season, because you're going to get a pretty damn good bowl after the season's over with. You're going to get a great bowl game after that. But for Georgia, that wasn't enough. That's mediocre compared to what Alabama does. Well, guess what, Georgia? You're not Alabama. You don't have a Nick Saban coach. Mark Richt could have been your Nick Saban, but guess what? You fired him. You fired him after 14 seasons because why? He had 2 bad seasons and all of a sudden he turns it around and goes 9-3? He was improving. And you didn't give him the time to develop the younger players that he had on his team. He was improving. His offense had been riddled with injuries all season, and he still went 9-3. The defense was okay. It was average, but it still got them a 9-3 season. And for some reason, it blows my mind that these teams are so caught up in the now that they can't see the future. If I'm an owner, my mind isn't set in the present. My mind is set 9 or 5 years down the road. That's where my mind wants to be. Where do I see this team being with the current coaching staff 5 years down the road? And if I'm a fan, I'm talking from a fan perspective right now, if I see that my team has a couple of crappy seasons, but I can tell that the talent is there. They just need time to grow and develop and get the playing time they need to learn how to play in this league. I'll take those lumps. I'll take a 2-14 season. I'll take a 6-10 season if I can see the improvement. If it's just the Cleveland situation where you have the same coach for 2 years and you consistently go 2-14 both seasons, then yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, fire that guy. But if the coach goes from 2-14 to 6-2, let him have that chance to develop his team and put the players that he wants to put on the field instead of who you want him to put on the field. But once again, the NFL's dollars and cents, man. That's why LA left. Or that's why the Rams left. That's why they went to LA. Dollars and cents. Don't care about the fan base. No. All right, let's get to the divisional series. Divisional playoffs. We're going to talk about the AFC first. KC versus the Pats. Once again, Tom Brady was Tom Brady. He's what you want in an NFL quarterback. And you saw that. You saw the brilliance that Bill Belichick came up with. KC was playing checkers. Bill Belichick was playing chess. He is the chess master in the postseason. Tom Brady went 28 for 42, 302 yards and 2 touchdowns on quick passes to Gronkowski and Edelman. Edelman had 10 catches for 100 yards and his return from a foot injury. The Chiefs' defense had absolutely no answer for this guy. They just outplayed the Chiefs. They outsmarted the Chiefs with in every facet of the game. Even when Bill Belichick essentially had pretty much stopped coaching in the final 5 minutes, the Chiefs still couldn't do anything. Andy Reid didn't want to score before the 2-minute warning, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, especially when you're down 14. You're down by 2 scores. And you run the clock down to a minute 13, and you're down by a touchdown now. And then you're going to take your chances by stopping Tom Brady with 3 timeouts. And you'll probably, if you do that, you might get the ball back on your own 20-yard line with about 30 seconds left on the clock. And you have to drive 80 yards downfield to do that. That's not how you beat New England. That's not how you beat the Patriots. That's not how you beat Tom Brady. That's not how you beat Bill Belichick. But that was just a beautiful performance by Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. The game plan, they had their game plan. They knew what the Chiefs were going to do, and they stuck to what they were practiced all week. They got the ball out with quick passes, didn't allow Kansas City's pass rush to get to them. Now they were hobbled a bit. Kansas City's passing game wasn't that great because Macklin was out. They didn't have the down threat ability that he gives you. Houston was banged up. Holly was banged up. But that's still no excuse. D Ford has to step up in that situation. There's no excuse for not getting Tom Brady, even with how quickly he was getting the ball out. But the England went on to win 27-20. This team's probably not going to lose anytime soon until they probably get to the Super Bowl. They're healthy. They got Gronk back. They've got Tom Brady at 100%. They've got Julian Edelman at 100%. Their defense can probably get back to 100% if anybody was hurt on that team. And I fully expect New England to get to the Super Bowl this year. I just don't see any team beating them this season. In the other AFC matchup, you had Pittsburgh at Denver. This game was a defensive battle from the opening coin toss. In a game where Big Ben was banged up heading in, and both Antonio Brown and D'Angelo Williams, the team's leading receiver and rusher, were both out, the Steelers' wide receiver core stepped up big in the first half. The nicked-up Pittsburgh Steelers brought a fight to Mile High Stadium that the Denver Broncos were not prepared for. The Broncos jumped out to a 6-point lead off of 2 field goals from Brett McManus, but the Steelers took the lead after a 1-yard touchdown run late in the first quarter, and from there on out, it was a field goal duel until midway through the fourth quarter. The Steelers were driving up 13-12 with 9 minutes to go in the game when Fitzgerald Toussaint took a big hit and fumbled the ball, and the Broncos would recover. That play was a huge momentum shift. It breathed new life back into Denver, and it was a sucker punch to the gut for the Pittsburgh Steelers. The Broncos then took the ball and drove downfield, and C.J. Anderson punched the ball in for the go-ahead touchdown with 3 minutes left and would go on to win the game 23-16. But the part to me that is amazing about this game was just how effective the Steelers' offense was in that first half. They played without Antonio Brown. Roethlisberger was not 100% during that game. His shoulder was jacked up. They needed players to step up in the passing game, and Martavis Bryant and Marcus Wheaton answered the call. Both defense in this game played exceptionally well. Peyton Manning, we all know, isn't what he used to be. The Steelers' defense got in his face all game. The O-line for Denver was absolutely terrible in this game. They got in his face. They forced him to try to beat them with his arm. And I'll give credit to the Broncos' defense here. They stepped up big in the second half. They pressured Big Ben. They shut down the running game. And they forced a fumble late that ultimately turned out to be the deciding factor in the game. And now the NFL gets the ratings matchup that they always wanted in the playoffs. What more could you ask for than Tom Brady, Peyton Manning going head-to-head for what is probably the final time? But we'll get into that more later in the episode. Now let's switch gears and go to the NFC, where Green Bay and Arizona played in an absolute absurd game. Aaron, I'm going to start off late in the fourth, because this is where the action really starts to pick up. Aaron Rodgers, with no time left on the clock, threw up a Hail Mary pass 65 yards downfield, and Jeff Janis, who ended the game with 7 receptions, 146 yards, and 2 touchdowns, comes down with a season-saving pass to tie the game at 20-all and force an overtime. Then, after Arizona wins the coin toss in overtime, on the very first play from scrimmage, Carson Palmer scrambles for his life to avoid the sack and finds a wide-open Larry Fitzgerald downfield who gallops all the way to Green Bay's 5-yard line. 2 plays later, it's only fitting that Palmer would get the ball to the man that got them down there in the first place, in Larry Fitzgerald. But the main thing about this game that I took away from it is the greatness of Aaron Rodgers. He didn't have his best wide receiver in Jordy Nelson all season. His receivers were unreliable all season. His offensive line couldn't block all season. They dropped passes all season. And he still led this team to the playoffs. He lost his second best wide receiver in Randall Cobb earlier in the game. And look what he did. Look what he did with the players that he had. If you've ever doubted Aaron Rodgers and how great he truly is, I'm going to give you the list of the receivers that he had during this game. These are the 3 leading receivers that he had. Jeff Janis, whose stats I mentioned earlier. He was the Packers' leading receiver in this game. A second-year guy out of Saginaw Valley, a D2 school in Michigan. Don't worry, I had to Google. I didn't know that off the top of my head. Jared Aberderis had 4 catches for 55 yards. He is also a second-year guy from Wisconsin. And Richard Rodgers, who hasn't done a single thing since week 12 of the regular season. Aaron Rodgers is a future Hall of Famer, and he showed you why in this game. You put the receivers he had tonight with any other quarterback, including Tom Brady and Peyton Manning and Russell Wilson, I'm still not sure that they get this team to the playoffs. This is an absurd thing, what he did. He took this subpar receiving core and turned them into a playoff-caliber team. Without Aaron Rodgers in this game at quarterback, Green Bay gets blown out of the water. I think that if it's any other quarterback, this Arizona defense straight up demolishes Green Bay. I don't think it's an overtime game. I don't think this game should have been 26-20, which is what it ended up being. But once again, man, Aaron Rodgers just one of the greatest quarterbacks to play the game outside of Tom Brady, to be honest with you. But in the end, the better team did win in Arizona, but I do not put that loss on Aaron Rodgers at all. If anything, I put that on the Green Bay defense for not being able to put pressure on Carson Palmer and finish the tackles in the backfield like they should have been doing all game. Then you got the other NFC matchup in Seattle and Carolina. This game did not go anywhere near where I expected it to go. But, hey, it's the NFL. What can you do? It's any given Sunday. Carolina jumped out to a 31-0 lead at the end of the first half behind the rushing game of Jonathan Stewart, who finished with 19 carries for 106 yards and 2 touchdowns. And Carolina's defense was forcing Russell Wilson to beat them with his arm, which he couldn't do. I never thought that he was the best passer in the first place. I think where he makes his bread and butter is with whenever the play breaks down and he can scramble and the coverage starts to break down and he starts finding open receivers. But for the most part, I don't think that he's the greatest pocket passer in the world. Wilson had 2 interceptions in the first half, one of which was returned for a touchdown by Luke Kuechly to put Carolina up 14-0 in the first quarter. Seattle ended up scoring 24 unanswered points in the second half, but that's partially because Carolina's defense backed off. They started playing prevent in the second half to not allow like big passes downfield or any way or anything like that. They allowed the short passes underneath to Seattle, and that gave them a little bit of life that they needed to make a comeback. And not trying to take away from anything from Seattle, they played a great second half. If they could have played like that during the first half, I'm sure this would have been a much different game. But I think the 2 interceptions early and the fact that Seattle could not get a rushing game going. Marshawn Lynch finished the game with 6 carries for 20 yards. He had an absolutely terrible game. They completely shut him down. And they made it to where Carolina could not run the ball anymore. They had to pass it to try to get back into the game. And that is where Carolina's defense really stepped up. I said it last week. If Seattle wanted to win this game, they had to dominate the rushing attack. Whichever team ran the ball better was going to win this game. And Carolina did that. Carolina's rushing game was by far and away the best in this game. And they're probably the best in the NFL at running the ball. The Carolina offensive line did whatever they wanted to do with Seattle's front 4 to open up the holes for Jonathan Stewart to run through. They won the battle in the trenches, which is what you have to do in the NFL. If you want to win any game in the NFL, that offensive line has got to play lights out. They have got to be the greatest. They have to beat the other front 4. The front 5 has to be the front 4 on defense. And in the NFL, that is the way it has to go. People can say that if you can just throw quick passes. Well, if you don't block anybody, quick passes don't work. And I think that's ultimately what won Carolina the game in Seattle 31-24. Now that we've covered all the divisional rounds, let's go ahead and start looking ahead to the championship round. Let's take a start with the AFC Championship. You got New England Patriots going to Denver. Like I said earlier, this is probably going to be the last matchup of the 2 greatest quarterbacks in NFL history. And it's probably going to be a blowout. Denver has a great passing defense in the league, but it won't be enough to beat Brady Beautiful, as my dad likes to call him, and the New England Patriots. Brady and Belichick beat the best passing defense in Kansas City last week by getting the ball out to Gronkowski and Edelman quickly and not allowing the pass rush to get to Tom Brady and allowing him to lose yards. I expect more of the same this week out of the New England Patriots. The Broncos' offense is struggling. Peyton Manning is not what he used to be. I think the defense is the only thing that keeps Denver in the game. They have to force turnovers. That secondary has got to step up and cover these guys and play press coverage and force Tom Brady to hold the ball longer than he wants to allow that pass rush with DeMarcus Ware and all of them to get back to Tom Brady and be able to sack him. But all that being said, I still don't think that that's enough for Denver to beat New England. I think New England wins this in Mile High 21-14. On the NFC side of the ball, this game is the best game that there's going to be this weekend. You got the 2 best teams in the NFL going head-to-head in Arizona and Carolina for a chance to go to Super Bowl 50. Both of these teams have a terrific running attack. Arizona has a slightly better passing game, mainly because they have veteran playmakers. They have Larry Fitzgerald, and they have Malcolm Floyd on the outside. Both defenses are the best in the league. Carolina has the best corner in the game in Josh Norman, and I fully expect him to follow Larry Fitzgerald around and be the shutdown corner that he is and nip at Larry Fitzgerald's heels like a little puppy and follow him around everywhere. With that being said, this game is going to come down like it did last week to running. Whichever team runs the ball is going to win this game. David Johnson, Jonathan Stewart have to have big games in the running game. I think Jonathan Stewart's a little bit stronger and faster than Johnson is, and he has a little bit more experience in the NFL with David Johnson being a rookie. So I'm going to go ahead and give the rushing attack edge to Carolina, and I think that's ultimately what gets them a win at home in a hard-fought battle, 17-14. Anyway, guys, that's going to do it for this episode of Let's Talk Sports. And again, thank you for all the love and support you guys have shown me. Be sure to follow the podcast on Twitter at @OneLetsTalkSports so you can keep up with the show and I can give you updates. And if you have questions, you can talk to me and everything like that. And like I said before, I'll be putting these out every Thursday. Once again, guys, thank you so, so very much for tuning in. And I'll talk to you guys next week.